XYZ News Talk Time, 10:07, the Mark Scott Show, Hour 2 for this Friday morning. This is the 20th of November, 1981. Good morning. 18 years after John Kennedy was gunned down in Dallas, his murder still has not been solved. The accused assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, apparently did not act alone. Acoustical experts have detected a fourth shot. Fired, they believe, by another assailant, waiting in ambush behind the grassy knoll. Did the late mobster John Roselli know who fired the mysterious fourth bullet? Did he later confide that terrible secret before his own death, which was violent in itself? Some people suspect that two of the mafia's most sinister godfathers, Carlo Macello and Santo Trafficante, are behind the plot to kill America's 35th president. Roselli agreed to knock off Fidel Castro for the Central Intelligence Agency in hope that a grateful United States government would overlook his occasional transgressions. One British journalist who is, by my way of thinking, one of the best in the world, very careful man who pays particular attention to detail, has done an excellent piece of work in documenting the fact that it is certainly possible that a renegade element in U.S. intelligence manipulated Lee Harvey Oswald. Whatever his role on November 22, 1963, that same element may have activated pawns in the anti-Castro movement in the mafia to murder the president. The man we're talking to this morning is that journalist, Anthony Summers, who just recently won the Golden Dagger Award for the best nonfiction book on crime for 1980. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Lux.
Tony, are you in the States now, or are you still in England?
Yes, I'm jet-lagged and in Baltimore.
Okay.
Got off the plane from London.
All right. Tony, in talking about, some people think, you know, that when you're talking about the assassination, that it's been 18 years and maybe you're just rehashing a lot of old things and it doesn't really make all that much difference. I've got to tell you that there's a great deal of apathy about this assassination that has set in during the last 18 years. Among journalists, for one thing, here in this country, certainly by the FBI, and although it was not by those members of the congressional, the assassination committee, led by the chief counsel, Robert Blakey, and congressmen as well. Their opinion and their thinking and their feeling about all of this has changed considerably. Now, I was talking just yesterday to a couple of people and trying to get some information about the acoustical reports, the statistical report on the acoustics that's being considered right now by the National Academy for Science. I talked with Professor Norman Ramsey at Harvard University, who is in charge of the National Academy of Science, and he tells me that report will be due the first of the year now, that it was supposed to come out in October. I asked him if he was having any difficulty. He said no, they were not. They just wanted to be very careful, and they too were certainly paying special attention to detail. So we can look for that report, and the report that we're talking about has to do with the acoustical report. The one that, by the way, that was put down by the FBI, the acoustical engineering company that concluded the two gunmen probably fired at President Kennedy, and they reject the report. So we'll see. We'll see what happens, I guess, at the first of the year.
Can I pick you up, Mark, before we get into the details of the acoustic thing?
Sure.
Can I pick you up on this business of apathy or not apathy?
Yes.
I think, you know, if we're going to talk for quite a few minutes now about the Kennedy assassination, that two things need saying. Yes, it was a long time ago, and there has been so much garbage written and talked about the Kennedy assassination. I think it was turned into fiction, for example, way back in the 60s, far too early, when it shouldn't have been, given that it was a matter of such huge historical and national emotional importance. But the fact remains that if Mark Scott had been murdered in 1960, 1953 or in 1953, and evidence was discovered later on to show that there hadn't been, justice hadn't been done, and that there were real loose ends in the case, then whether he was Mark Scott or President Kennedy or somebody who wasn't even as well known as you are, then legally, the investigation should continue. Chief Counsel Blakey of the Congressional Committee, whom you mentioned just now, has said rightly that there is no statute of limitations on murder. The Congressional Committee met for 2 or 3 years in a massive flack from the media, a lot of it undeserved, spent $6 million, did a lot of hard work, got rid of a lot of the garbage that surrounds the case, and came to the conclusion that there had been a conspiracy, and it wasn't just because of the acoustics evidence. So if we live in a democracy, and if that democracy lives up to its name, especially in the case of a murdered president, then the wheels of justice should continue to grind. It doesn't really matter whether people care about it or not. But my judgment is, as a foreign journalist who became interested for a sense in this case a few years ago, my judgment is that, in fact, the American people, rather than the media, is not really bored with the case. They wish that somebody would buckle to and come up with the answers and do the homework. They don't think the homework has been done properly. And certainly all responsible polls show, one, that the people have listened to the serious evidence showing there was a conspiracy and that they would like to see it cleared up. That said, compared to the last time I spoke with you a year ago, I am skeptical now that justice will be seen to be done. I think that the Department of Justice, the FBI, are flatulent, to say the least, about this case. I think the best one can do is for responsible people to go on talking about it and working at it and trying to get congressmen and so on to move.
We'll find out why you think that way. WXYZ News Talk Time 1016 of the Mark Scott Show. We're talking about conspiracy and the assassination of John Kennedy this morning. We're talking with reporter Anthony Summers. Tony.
Yep.
When we think about the conspiracy, there's so, as you pointed out before, there have been so many books written and there's so much evidence, and I want to talk just a bit about David Lifton and your impressions of his book, Best Evidence. But before we do, let's pursue just a little farther the last comment that you made and the fact that you say that you don't think that there is any hope that justice will win out.
I think one has to work on the assumption that there's hope, like everything else in life. What I'm saying is that after so many years have gone by, that there have been two main moments when I think the case had a real chance of being investigated properly. If you leave aside the first hurried, thorough in many ways, but inadequate investigation, the Warren Commission inquiry, which has now been thoroughly and formally and officially discredited. That one moment was in 1967, when, apart from the people who were writing sensational stories, there were also responsible people showing the flaws in the case that said that Oswald had done it and Oswald had done it alone. And that was a moment, of course, when the district attorney in New Orleans, Jim Garrison, came in on the act. And because his investigation, as we all know, ended up in total fiasco, I think the real investigation was set back by many years. I think that was probably the moment at which the chances of justice being done received their greatest setback. And then there was the congressional inquiry, which started at the end of the 70s and reported just 2 years ago now. And I think that was the other moment at which things should have been able to go forward. They decided that there had been somebody else shooting on the basis of the scientific evidence, particularly the acoustics evidence, and also produced a mass of material. I guess we'll have to talk about acoustics, but the acoustics was only the scientific thing with which they topped off their pile of evidence. In fact, on the Kennedy case, they produced 12 volumes of material, and it's not just 12 volumes of congressional waffle. It's 12 volumes of very carefully organized material, and anyone who comes, I haven't met anyone who's actually sat down and read it who comes away thinking, no conspiracy. Everyone comes away saying there was a conspiracy. And the Congressional Committee handed that material on to the Department of Justice, saying, there you are. We've cleaned away all the nonsense. These are the leads. What we think is that there should now be further investigation by the Department of Justice. What the Department has done since then is to freewheel. The FBI, as you said, has to some extent publicly shot down the acoustics evidence. It was a very shabby report. They didn't actually shoot it down in practical terms. And even a non-scientist like myself can see that the report that they've done just isn't enough. All that they've really said is that the acoustics evidence doesn't prove conclusively that there was another man on the grassy knoll and that he was shooting from there. They don't say that the acoustics evidence was wrong. I think we shouldn't hope for too much from the National Academy of Sciences. They're scientists. They will not agree. There will be dissenters from the report, even if there are those who also say that the acoustics evidence stands up. What needs pursuing is the mass of other evidence pointing to living individuals who are suspects in the case. The media has given very little coverage to all this, and that, I hope, was perhaps the most positive function of my own book.
Well, I think so, and I think the fact that you point that out in the book is extraordinary. And you know, I have to say that I was not one to believe in the conspiracy theory for a number of years. After the 1978 congressional report came out, I didn't even read that. I still went ahead, as I think a lot of people in this country, and just said, well, you know, it's another report, and so they come out and they say that, and maybe they want to write books. And it wasn't until the time when I had the opportunity of talking with Robert Blakey, G. Robert Blakey, he was chief counsel at the time, and even more convincingly, after going through the evidence and material that you have put together, Tony, that I realized that, in fact, the conspiracy was not only possible, that conspiracy was probable, and it was a matter of trying to draw the lines or the parallel lines of where the conspiracy might lead.
Let me interrupt you a moment there. You say, Mark, you know, we've talked about the things that have held up the case and why things have reached this pass so many years later of apathy and so on. Much of it has been about the carelessness with which the case has been reported, and some of the things which seem rather more offensive than just carelessness. When you introduced me, you referred to me as a British reporter. That I certainly am, but I fear that in this country, most people will have heard in recent years about the British reporter, who is not me, I hasten to say, who has been striving all these years to have Lee Oswald dug up and succeeded a few months ago. His suggestion was that Lee Oswald, who was involved in Dallas on the day of the assassination, was not really the real Lee Oswald, but a Russian stooge who'd come back from Russia in Oswald's place after he defected there. He had zero evidence to support the notion that the real Oswald wasn't buried in the grave, and he blithely ignored the fact that the man who was buried in Dallas had the fingerprints of the real Lee Oswald.
We most definitely want to clarify that.
Oh, yeah. He had the fingerprints of the real Lee Oswald, and what's more, and perhaps even more important to the ordinary person listening at home, Oswald's mother recognized Oswald until he died as being her son. Well, I don't know many old mums who don't recognize their sons. It was a nonsense story, yet this story was introduced, at the end of the 60s, and went on and on through the 70s, always coming up with a great fanfare of publicity, notably at crucial moments on the responsible side of the investigation and blurring the issue. Well, finally, the man was dug up, and of course he was Lee Oswald, as I pointed out, as I said I was certain would be the case when I wrote my book a couple of years ago. Perhaps this was just bad, fuzzy reporting by by a careless old fellow countryman of mine, or perhaps it was a little more sinister, perhaps it was deliberate disinformation to blur the case. I don't know, but that's the kind of reason that we've come to this very lousy situation in the Kennedy affair. And I think that if investigation is to go anywhere usefully, apart from talking about it on shows like this and running the odd sensational story about wrong bodies in graves, it can only come from either from Congress or the Justice Department. And since that is happening so slowly, and since there are other things taking, obviously, priority to that day-to-day things, the only way it will move is if responsible reporters in this country and responsible editors actually shake themselves and work on the story hard and use the leverage that you have in this country to get the official world working. But my guess is that that isn't going to happen.
We're going to take your calls now and give you an opportunity to talk with Tony Summers about the conspiracy. WXYZ toll-free lines are open for your calls. Southfield, Berkeley, and Beverly Hills, 353-TALK. Livonia, Canton, and Garden City, 425-TALK. Detroit, Allen Park, and Dearborn, 873-TALK. Or dial the WXYZ talk line nearest your exchange. WXYZ News Talk Time, 1025 on the Mark Scott Show. We are talking with Tony Summers, journalist Tony Summers, this morning about his book, Conspiracy, and more, even more important, the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Tony, I want to get to the phones. We got a lot of people who want to talk with you, and I think maybe we'll do that right now. Good morning. You're on WXYZ.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I would like to ask Mr. Summers, at the time the Warren Report came out, we were encouraged to read it, but there was evidence sealed up for 85 years not to be revealed for that length of time. Now, why were we asked to study an incomplete report?
Tony?
It was sealed up for 85 years.
Yeah, 85 years isn't quite right, but there is some material there, as Chief Justice Warren said at the time, which he said that for security reasons, that there was material that could not be looked at for many years. And I think there was also material which it was felt at the time for respect to the family, medical evidence and so on, that there are certain things should not be looked at. I think that, as you would see if you read my book or read the recent congressional material, that security cannot be used, certainly cannot be used now, as an excuse for keeping files on the assassination closed. If indeed, and this is the important thing, if indeed one man, one young, lone, not if you like, politically obsessed man, if you like, Oswald, did kill the president by himself on an impulse, on a whim, because he was against American policy towards Castro, for example, then there really is no reason why any significant evidence in the case should be covered up on the basis of security.
Tony, I could never understand why it was that more witnesses that were unmentioned and went by unquestioned by the Warren Commission.
Yes, the thing is that the Warren Commission, which of course published 26 volumes of evidence, which you can go and read, by the way, listener, and the main Warren report, it looks so convincing. They did do a lot of work. On the other hand, just take one example. This is in my book, and I think it's terribly important. It only takes up a few pages, but the crucial matter, if Oswald did shoot the president, is where was Oswald at the time of the assassination? And the is that witnesses did give evidence to the police within hours and days of the assassination. People who worked in that building, the Texas School Book Depository, with Oswald. There weren't that many of them, just the staff of that building. And the Warren Commission report said nobody in the building saw Oswald downstairs after, I think it was 11:45, 11:50, and the assassination was at 12:30. Well, it's just simply not true. There were those who saw him downstairs in the lobby near the Bank of Telephones. One wonders why he was standing there. Way down as late as 12:15, and in one crucial case, a woman who knew Oswald well, who handed him his pay packet and so on every week, saw him downstairs as late, as far as we can judge, as 11:25. A very good witness who gave her evidence within hours of the assassination was never questioned again. and her evidence and those of others, that of others, was not even mentioned in the Warren Commission report. Now that's at very best sloppy, and at very worst suggests that the Warren Commission knew about this and simply preferred to cover it up. That's very serious.
18 years after John Kennedy was gunned down in Dallas, his murder still has not been solved. We're talking about that this morning here on the Mark Scott Show with Anthony Summers, the author of Conspiracy. News Talk Time, 10:32 on the Mark Scott Show. Did the late mobster John Roselli know who fired the mysterious fourth bullet that assassinated President John Kennedy? The plot to kill the president. Well, we've talked to an expert on that, a couple of them, as a matter of fact. We are talking this morning with Tony Summers, who is a journalist and has written the book Conspiracy. Tony, we've talked with G. Robert Blakey. Matter of fact, I talked with Blakey one point when I had you on the air.
Yep.
And when we both talked about this particular situation. Blakey, by the way, is in Washington this weekend. He and Congressman Lou Stokes are putting together, proposing some legislation which has to deal with assassinations.
Yes.
And I found that out yesterday when I was trying to track down some of this information about the acoustical report and the findings of the New England firm Bolt, Beranek & Newman, and the fact that the FBI report has disputed those findings. I know that all the report concluded was that the commission didn't prove that the shot came from the grassy knoll because the scientist only did it to a 95% degree. There was a 5% chance of error.
Yes, but you know that it's...
That's the way scientists are. I mean, scientists don't come out and say it's 100% correct. They always leave that 5% chance, don't they?
Well, sure. I mean, if you actually say to a scientist, is it 100% certain that if you drop an apple, it'll hit the ground, the scientist will, given a couple of minutes, he'll talk around it and say, well, you see, yes, sir, unless so-and-so and so-and-so. And so you're right to some extent. There are some new doubts about the acoustics evidence, which seem to be real doubts. And these are things that the National Academy of Sciences panel, which reports at the beginning of the year, arising from the congressional, from the Blakey inquiry, will be looking at. And I think there's one particular thing which is worrying them.
Can you tell us?
Yes. The debate seems to stem from an observation made just last fall by a researcher who's found an interpretation for some barely audible words on one of the police recordings. You know that the sounds of the shots that they thought they'd found, which led them to their acoustics conclusions, came from a routine police tape made of all transmissions.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that one policeman traveling on a motorbike, escorting the motorcade through Dealey Plaza, had his microphone button pushed down, and therefore his channel had stayed open from his motorbike, and he'd happened to record the shots. Now, there were two channels, two police radio channels, and one of the tapes, starting just after the last shot, appeared to be include the words from one of the sheriffs on the scene, hold everything secure until the homicide and other investigators can get there. Now, the trouble is that you can figure out that comment was made at least a minute after the first shot was fired, in other words, in response to the assassination. And if the words on one channel were the same words heard on another channel, and if the channels were continuous, as they should have been, sorry, it's a bit complicated, then the sounds that appeared to be shots and were judged to be shots after a huge investigation by the committee could not have been, because obviously the sheriff would not have been talking about the assassination, the operation immediately following the assassination, within a moment of the last shot. We know that it took a minute or so for things to start being done by the police. So they're very worried about that. It may mean that these things that we thought were shots for the last 2 or 3 years may not be. On the other hand, you'll find that the people who did the investigation for the Congressional Committee will come back with other explanations, like the police belt jumping, like recording that was jostled, recordings that were made over the original recording later. It won't be a satisfactory answer, and I stress, and I imagine that Chief Counsel Blakey will stress when this report comes out, that the acoustics evidence, which is certainly important, is absolutely not everything. As I say, 12 volumes of evidence, a massive material pointing to real suspects, and extraordinary flaws in the human evidence of the affair and the activities and connections of the people involved in the assassination story, which point strongly to conspiracy. And these are the things that a proper, responsible Department of Justice inquiry should be looking at, not just the acoustics evidence.
Well, it's interesting that taking that tape from 63, that the acoustics people were able to match the echo patterns to the hypothetical shot from the grassy knoll to a 95% plus degree of fit. The conclusion in the report is that there is scientific evidence establishing a high probability that there was a shot from the grassy knoll, and only a high degree of probability. Now, they didn't say it came from the grassy knoll and no place else.
Well, they did in a way. The extraordinary thing was that all they had was a tape. They were given the tape by the committee, which had been given it in turn by a researcher in Dallas, on the possibility that it would show something. They didn't think it would. To their surprise, the firm they handed the tape out to, which was the most distinguished firm in the field, which produced evidence, for example, on who fired first and from where in the Kent State University shootings cases, and also investigated the famous gap in the Nixon tapes. You remember the business of Rosemary Woods and the long gap.
Yeah, my audience knows that I vaguely remember that.
Right. The same firm investigated those things and has produced evidence in court, which has been part of the evidence leading to judgments. They looked into this and they found that there were sounds on the tape which could not just be static on the tape, but were supersonic and therefore shots.
Is that how they're explaining the four events on the tape?
Yes, they say that there were at least four things which could not be explained as anything, in their opinion, but supersonic sounds, which couldn't be car backfires, but must have been shots. One of these shots, the third one, they pinpointed, after reconstructions and so on in Dealey Plaza, to a particular place. Now, they were working on no other data, right? But it happens that the particular place that they named for the fourth shot happens to be within a couple of feet, which is a pretty close margin in an enormous place. It happens to coincide precisely with the place on the famous grassy knoll fence area up to the right in front of the president, which is where people on the day said that they saw a puff of smoke, people standing looking suspicious before the assassination, people running away afterwards, and so on.
Tony, isn't there also a correspondence between the events on the film and the events on the tape as to timing and direction?
Yes, there is. If you line the two things up together, the famous Zapruder film and the tape, you have a...
Wouldn't one question the FBI then?
Sort of way on vision and sound, yeah.
Wouldn't one question to the FBI be, how did they by chance correspond to the events in the plaza?
That would be one question of the FBI, but the FBI hasn't really wanted to ask any questions.
Well, it's a surprise. It's not surprising considering the way they botched the job back in 63.
Well, yes, indeed. And, you know, going back to your first listener's question about records and records not being allowed to be looked at, we're not just talking about records that we can't see because they've been classified. And I think often classified just for stupid bureaucratic reasons, not really because of any real need for secrecy, but by classifying them, a spooky atmosphere is created about things. But apart from that, of course, we have the whole problem of documents that have been destroyed. A letter that Oswald had written to the FBI in Dallas just before the assassination was destroyed on the spot in Dallas, taken by an FBI agent on his superior's orders into the men's room there, torn up and flushed down the drain.
Tony, I want you to tell us more about documents of this nature, and I want you to tell us about that and what the Acoustics Works really shows us. WXYZ News Talk Time, 10:43 of the Mark Scott Show. We're talking with Tony Summers, author of Conspiracy. We're talking about the Kennedy assassination, and good morning. You're on WXYZ.
Good morning, Mark. Bill from Troy.
Yes, Bill.
Mark, I'd like to, you and Mr. Summers, I've been thinking the best way to put this together. I'd like to make a statement, and then I'll hang up and listen for any comments from either of you. And this is from memory, so I'm going to do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to the Kennedy assassination, in the Detroit area here, they had a TV program on called Probe. It was put on by Professor Burke, and it was sponsored by a local savings and loan association here in the Detroit area. And then if you wrote in, they would send you a copy of that particular night's program. The night that I was watching it, the title, as I remember, was called The Venomous One. The professor had spent a weekend in Texas in a multimillionaire's home, and he and some college students were there. And he went on to tell how this individual, who the United States had been so good to in making him a millionaire, the venomous attack that he had on the United States, and in particular the Kennedys. He made the remark that the only way to get the Kennedys out of the White House was to shoot them out. I sent in and got a copy of that, and I had it, and I sent it to Jim Garrison, the prosecuting attorney in New Orleans. I still have the receipt that I sent it registered, and his office had to sign for it. I sent all that in, Mark, never got any reply from anybody on it. Professor, the man that put the show on was in Pontiac a few years ago. I tried to contact him there, but that was to of no avail. But I thought, now this was quite a while prior to the Kennedy assassination, and I thought when I heard it and seen it on TV, I couldn't believe it. That's why I sent in and got a copy of it. And when he said that the individual made the remark, the only way to get the Kennedys out would be to shoot them out, I thought that was a pretty strong statement to make, Mark. And I just, since you had your guest on today, it took me back to that time. And I thought it was pretty valuable information, but no one carried the ball with it. But the program was Probe. It can be documented. It was a local TV program here in the Detroit area, Mark. And I'm going to hang up and listen to see if anybody, if Mr. Summers had ever heard of this.
Tony, you want to make some comments on that?
Yes, I don't think that particular recording. I've heard of a lot of things like it, and I would say, yes, of course, it's interesting. It isn't necessarily important as evidence. It's certainly something that should have been looked at the time. If it was a millionaire in Dallas and people close to him talking like that before the assassination, I wouldn't be amazed if it turned out to be something to do with the oil millionaire Hunt. However, this angle was looked into pretty seriously, both by the Warren Commission and by the Congressional Committee on Assassinations a year or two ago. And whilst it doesn't mean that your listener is onto nothing, I think there's no reason why it should necessarily be relevant to the real assassination evidence. You know, if you're planning to or remotely involved with murdering anybody, let alone the president, you don't usually go on the record a couple of days before talking about shooting him out of the White House. And they're the kind of things that look terribly sinister after the event. And in fact, particularly in the climate of those times, when a lot of violent language was being used, you remember it was the era of the war, the almost open war against Fidel Castro and the like, a lot of wild things were being said a lot of the time by people obviously by far right wingers and so on, but also by people in authority in many cases. A lot of wild, angry talk against the Kennedys in public, and a lot of it looked very bad afterwards, and they wish they hadn't said it. I would suspect it comes in that category.
Mm-hmm. Tony, let me get back here to this motorcycle situation and the dicta belt. And how do you explain the commission's ability to find a photo of the cycle officer, H.B. McLean, on his bike in the plaza and in precisely the same place where the acoustics say he had to have been in order to be broadcasting? You know, in each of the places, He had to have been in each of these places in order for the recordings to have been valid. And these aren't phantom shots.
Well, that's right. These are two of the things that made the acoustics evidence seem so very valid when they were produced a year or so ago. One was the fact that, remember, they were only given a tape in the first place. They didn't know if they'd find anything on it. They did find sounds that, in their opinion as eminent scientists, were shots rather than just vague noises. And they found that one of them, the third one, had come from a point where long ago and ever since witnesses have said that there were shots coming. They had to locate it as being, they said this must have been coming from a moving microphone, and logically a police microphone, since it was a police tape. So they looked for a police microphone, which meant probably a motorbike or a car, and they found a motorbike which was moving at the right speed along the right stretch of road at precisely the right time. And then they found him in the photographs, having gone through all the film and stills taken at the time of the assassination. So it seems that it couldn't possibly be coincidence. There is now, as we said earlier, there is some doubt thrown on this by the National Academy of Sciences panel, which is looking into the thing for the congressional, as a result of the congressional committee's work, because it seems that there were that some of the other sounds on the tape don't make sense in terms of the timing. I think that there will just be, a disagreement by the scientists at the end, which is what scientists normally do, and probably this will be reported in the media as though the acoustics evidence has all been shot down.
Well, I don't doubt that, but you know,
I don't want to get away from you on this acoustics evidence. I'm not a scientist. I've read all the stuff, and I shall continue to read it. But the important thing is to not imagine that the whole case for conspiracy hangs on the acoustics evidence. I've never said that.
And that's precisely the point that G. Robert Blakey has made as well in supporting what you have put together, Tony.
Yes, and I think, however, it's going to it's proving to be and will prove to have been a pity that because they felt that the scientific evidence was so strong, that the Congressional Committee and Chief Counsel Blakey leaned on the acoustics evidence almost alone, although they knew that they had all this other evidence. They thought that was so clear that the acoustics evidence was the thing that was bound to get the judicial establishment moving on the case. They were mistaken. The judicial establishment hasn't moved, and if the acoustics evidence now appears to be falling apart, and it may do when this final report comes out in January, then they'll be hard put to it to say, oh yes, but what about the other 12 volumes of material? There will just be a sort of corporate yawn from the establishment after that. It's a pity.
WXYZ News Talk Time, 10:54, The Mark Scott Show. Tony Summers, our guest. We're talking about the conspiracy behind the assassination to John Kennedy. Tony, we only have a couple of minutes left here. Good morning. You're on WXYZ.
Hi, Mark. This is Mary. First-time caller from Detroit.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for your call.
I'm wondering if there's any way after all these years that they could possibly, find whoever else is involved with that. And if not, why don't they just let it lie? Or is it just a money-making scheme for, the man now that's on that, is selling a book for it.
Mary, I have to tell you, you don't make that much money off books on John Kennedy's assassination right now.
Uh-huh. Well, so is there any way after 18 years that they could possibly, catch anybody that was involved?
Tony, what do you think?
This is really where we started. The fact is, though, you don't make a lot of money out of working on this case. If you cover your expenses, that's pretty good. The time that one made money was back in the 60s when people were making sensational stories. Can one catch anybody? Well, the chief counsel of the Assassinations Committee Robert Blakey said a year or so ago that he thought that, and this is more or less a quote, that there were living suspects who had been pinpointed by his committee after 3 years of careful slogging work in Congress, walking about in America, who should be following, say, 2 or 3 months of proper investigation by the FBI and the Justice Department. And he felt that some of those living suspects could still be indicted for involvement in the murder of the president. There's no limitation. There's no statute of limitations on murder in this country, and therefore, from the legal point of view, if he's right, and I think he is right, yes, people could still be put in court. That aside, it seems to me that, you know, talking about just letting a matter lie, it's a matter of great historical importance. It remains a matter of historical importance whether Hannibal used elephants to cross the Alps way back in the year dot. So historians will never let it lie because they're interested in history. And I think it's in the interest of justice still to pursue this matter. But we're now right on the dusty borderline between between a news event and history, and I very soon it's going to be over that borderline and into the area of history. As I've said, I think that the thing should still be pursued and just about can be with the possibility of prosecutions, but my guess is that it won't be, and it will remain the active pursuit of historians years to come.
Tony, I want to thank you very much. Mary, I want to thank you for your question. Tony, it was a pleasure talking with you again. Your book, Conspiracy, I think, goes down as probably one of the best out of all that I have ever read. And I thank you very much for being a guest on our show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, Tony. Talk to you again another time. Tony Summers, Conspiracy, the book. And that kind of wraps up our this hour of our show. We're going to have open line conversation coming up at 11:30. And in this next hour, we're going to talk about conversationally speaking and how you might, some tested new ways to increase your social and personal effectiveness and how to start that conversation.